this very interesting part of the Hamiltonian dynamics. And basically, the idea is that basically every system which is sufficiently generic will be chaotic and will display chaotic behavior. And you have only these, very, very measure zero number of, integrable systems. And then once you start perturbing them, they will be chaotic. So anyway, so let us now return back to this prototype of classical field theory, Maxwell's theory, which is the most famous theory there is to be. And so, we have gone a long way. Basically, started with the Maxwell equations, which are written in terms of the intensities E and B, electric field and magnetic field. And then we did some clever mathematical trick, is that we said, well, some of the equations are actually satisfied, provided we introduce these potentials phi and a. And that basically kills half of the equations. And moreover, we gain the fact that actually, in terms of phi and a, the theory is a gauge theory. So there's a gauge freedom as such, which leaves E and B invariant. All right, so we already know that. And then the question is what the remaining two set of equations, the equations with sources, this and that, actually give us in terms of the potential phi and a. And it's a simple calculation to show that if you use the Lorentz gauge, which you can impose because of this gauge freedom here, then you end up with two wave equations which seem very, very similar. So basically, if we can solve one of these equations, then the other one can be solved easily as well. Where we arrived at this, box operator, and it's a wave equation, we have propagation of waves, we predicted light, and so on, right? So now, what is our task for today? I want to do two things. First, I want to show you really how to solve this wave equation, and we will be using the method of Green's functions for that. And then I will show you how to write explicit solution if you just have propagation of one particle, well, let's say one electron, but what the fields are produced by this electron. All right, so the first task is really to solve this. And this is our ansatz for the solution. So we seek the solution of the wave equation boson phi minus phi pi rho in this ansatz, where there's an integral over the energy density, charge density, and then the G is the Green's function. So now we demand that this G is basically like a field of a point-like charge, like that. And so here we are using the fact that actually the space is isotropic and time is homogeneous and so on. So we can really put the dependence on R and R prime into capital R and capital T. So now, really, to convince you that this solution really solved this equation, let me just repeat that. So we seek boson phi. Okay, that's 4 pi. And then you have the integral. And then you will have boson g, and then nothing else on the right-hand side actually depends on r and t. But of course, this box is a, what we are doing here is really we are differentiating with respect to time, not t prime, but time, and we are differentiating with respect to r, not r prime. So everything else is actually untouched. R prime, t prime, dr prime, dt prime. But by definition, this thing here gives us just the delta function, the minus delta r minus r prime, delta t minus t prime. This is a three-dimensional delta. That's a one-dimensional delta. That is a four-dimensional delta. All right. And so we can integrate easily. We just replace wherever we see r prime, if we replace it with r. And so this really gives us minus 4 pi rho r and t. All right, so really, if we can find this G satisfying that, then we have a solution of our problem. All right, so now let's find the G, and that will take us maybe half an hour. So let's do it. And it's a useful calculation. You will do it again and again. So why not to do it? Okay. So you want to find G. We do the Fourier transform. you know, if time were periodic or space were periodic, as in our tutorial, you would replace Fourier transform with Fourier series, and things would get more complicated because always when you're summing, it's more complicated than integrating. But anyway, all right. So we seek G, R, and T in the form 1 over 2 pi. That's just a prefactor. It depends on how you define your Fourier transform and how you define the inverse Fourier transform. There's always 2 pi somewhere. Let's just put it here. So if you put it here, it won't be present in the inverse Fourier transform. Dk d omega e to I k times r minus I omega times t, and then the Fourier picture of G, let's just call it GK omega. So we are transforming, Fourier transforming both space and time to actually do this. And so, of course, it is always the case that in this Fourier picture, it's easy to solve for what this guy is. So indeed, let's impose the equation which we want. So box on G. Well, it's just the prefactor. We again pull the box inside. And then if you look at which things depend on T, capital T and capital R, it's just this exponential, right? So everything else is just function of K and omega. So it's just that which depends on R and T. So for example, if I do, what I need to do is I need to do two time derivatives here. Okay, so all I need to do is I have to differentiate exponential twice. So each, when I differentiate with respect to t, brings down I omega. Right? So I will have I omega twice. So I square is minus one. But remember, there's also this minus d square over dt square. So there's an extra minus from the definition of your box. All right? So that in the end means that I will have omega square here. I square is one minus, is another minus, so there's a plus. And similarly for R, so each differentiation with respect to R will bring me k down as a vector now. And again, so I will have ik, and ik again brings me a minus sign. So it's minus k square, and then g k omega. Everybody happy so far?
We still need the exponential.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. Be careful what I'm doing, okay? I will make so many mistakes. So okay, very good. So now this thing here, again, you know, has to be, so what we are really solving is this equation. Equal to minus delta function. So now, I believe you have seen a representation of the delta function in the Fourier space. It's basically the Fourier representation is just one. Okay, so this is equal to minus 1 over 2 pi 4 dk d omega, and then the exponential. So that's our delta function. Okay, so now if this is an equality, we have the same integral, we can put it under the same integration. So certainly we can satisfy this if this times that equals to minus one. Okay. So in other words, we have a solution that g, k, and omega is 1 over a square minus omega square. So we solved our problem, but unfortunately still only in the Fourier space. Well, that's a nice solution which we have here. So now let's try to put it back into the X space, right? So far, everybody happy with this? Okay, so that was easy. So let's undo the Fourier transform. And so our GRT is this thing here. So we now need to do this integral here. GRT 1 over 2 pi 4. Okay, let me just write it there first. Dk d omega 1 over k square minus omega square gi k times r minus I omega t. Okay, so that's what we need to do, this integral. So now to do this integral, let's choose some clever coordinates. Okay, so the clever coordinates will be, okay, so I have a scalar product here between k and r. Okay, so these are two vectors. There will be some angle in between them, right? So if I have k and r, there will be some angle here. Let's call it theta. And then you know that the scalar product between the two vectors is just the magnitude of k times magnitude of r times cosine theta in between them, right? Well, this thing here, now I'll be able to write as a k r cosine theta minus I omega t. Okay. But then we need to do the integral over k, a three-dimensional integral. And the best is to choose spherical coordinates in that k space. Right? So what I can do is that I can certainly choose some angle phi, and then choose whichever that is, azimuthal angle or whatever, this theta. Right? So my spherical coordinates will be phi, theta, and the magnitude of k. Okay? So now you do this thing here, you do two spherical coordinates. In the k, a. So this d3 of k will just become an integral of d phi, d cosine theta, and then a square. K square dk, where this is no longer a vector, but it's rather a magnitude of that, right? Okay, very good. So we can do that. So now, of course, nothing depends on phi. So we can integrate phi, it just gives us 2 pi, right? So g of r and t gives us 1 over 2 pi cubed. And then we have an integral d cosine theta d square dk. We also still have the integral over omega. And then what we integrate here is just magnitude k square minus omega square, and then e to I k r cosine theta minus I omega t. I'm doing this really, really slowly, but that's I think it's good, right? So far we have just done, we have chosen the spherical coordinates in k space. We have chosen that the theta between the two vectors is really the theta on the sphere, which we like, and we have done the integration over the phi angle, which was trivial. So now, but you see that the dependence on the theta is also sort of trivial, right? So the only appearance of theta is over here in this exponential. Of course, when you integrate d cos theta, you integrate from minus 1 to 1. So cos theta takes minus 1 to 1. And so integrating exponential with, you know, this thing here is super simple. It's just, you know, I plug there plus one minus one, and that's it. Picking up ik at the bottom, right? So this is equal to 1 over 2 pi cube. So now each integration will be bring me, you know, ikr down 1 over ir. This is the magnitude. And then integral e omega, and I still have the integral k square dk, but this brings me 1 over k down. So that will be I k r. Okay, also that will be a translation here. And then it's I k r minus I minus I k r, and then the whole thing. And I still have the k square minus omega square. Okay, so this is just integration over cosine theta. And let's hope this is right. Is there any mistake?
No.
Okay. Okay, perfect. So now we have, you know, cancellation of one of the k's. All right. So now we will have to do eventually the integral over, well, let me just introduce a shorthand and let me notice something. So when we integrate over k, the k is the magnitude of k, right? So it's like a radial coordinate. So k goes from 0 to infinity, so a radial coordinate. So now if you look at here, the only dependence on k of all this thing here is through the magnitude of k here. And there's a magnitude of k here. But then there's an integral which has plus here. And then there's an integral which has minus here. So what it means is that if I integrate from 0 to infinity, well, in fact, I can just, you know, take one of these terms here and just integrate from minus infinity to plus infinity. OK, so we can do just one of these. And do one. Just one of these, provided the integral from 0 to infinity is replaced to the integral from minus infinity to infinity. Anyway, so what is it? What this is, well, let's write it like that. It's an integral IR d omega e to minus I omega t, and let's call this I, where this I is now an integral from minus infinity to infinity k dk e to I kr divided by k square minus omega square. Everybody happy?
Is this boundaries from 0 to infinity in the original Fourier transform, and now it's turned into minus infinity to infinity?
Yeah. So originally, you know, our magnitude of k was just like a radial coordinate in spherical coordinates. The radial coordinates always go from 0 to infinity. Oh. Right? So now, how I change that from minus infinity to infinity is that I have two terms. I have one term here. There's a plus here in the exponential. And I have another term, it's a minus here in the exponential, right? So now if I do integral of from 0 to infinity of that and 0 to infinity of that, then in fact, because there's a minus sign here, I'm actually like doing one integral of just this term here, but from minus infinity to infinity, just for convenience. OK, think about it. Everybody happy with this? OK. So now we are almost done, right? Well, not quite. We need to do this, you know, complex integral. Well, this is a real integral, but of course, you will do it in complex plane. And you immediately see a problem. So this is an integral over the real axis from minus infinity to infinity. But on that real axis, there is two poles, one at k equal to omega and one at k equal to minus omega. Right? So what we really want to do, so we have complex plane of k here, and then what we want to do is the integral like that, but we have a pole at minus omega here, and then we have another pole at plus omega here. So what we really want to do is, this integral here. But you immediately see that this integral is not well defined because, of course, there is a blow up near the two poles. Okay. And so then we have to decide what we want to do about these two poles. Okay. And so the simplest thing you might think is just to take the principal value of the integral. Right. So I just, go as close as I can to the pole, but actually I don't integrate across the pole. And similarly, I do it here. So we take simplest to take principal value. Where we basically ignore the contributions of the poles, sort of. So now how this principal value is calculated is, well, we want to calculate this integral from minus infinity to infinity by employing, the Cauchy integral formula or something like that. And so we better choose a contour which is closed in the complex plane and which we can easily calculate. Okay, and so one way close to contour is that I just go around these poles like that. So if you haven't taken any complex analysis, please, try to read some introduction to complex analysis. I'm sure Dan will use it all the time. And then we close the contour at infinity like that. Okay, so we will have an integral of our contour, which is a closed curve, and the complex plane just goes like that, and goes to infinity, closes to infinity. And okay. So now we know that if you integrate things over a closed contour, and then inside that contour, closed contour, there is no any poles, and you get zero. Okay. So we have zero equals two. Right? And so then, okay, very good. So then this zero, of course, gives us the integral over this line plus that half circle plus this line, plus that half circle, plus that line, plus that line. Okay. So now what we want is our integral I. So this is the I. So this plus that is I. And we will have some integral I1 here over that half circle. And we will have I2 over this half circle. And then we'll have I3 over that large circle. So zero is basically I. So now what matters always in these integrations is how you choose the orientations of your curves. Right? Like typically you want to go like that, and close, right? So you want to go in the same direction. I have on purpose chosen that here I'm going in the opposite direction. So that means that the zero is I minus I1 minus I2, the minus coming from the fact that I'm going opposite to what I want to go, plus I3. Very good. So integral over I3, difficult. Okay, you have to integrate I, chi, and kr over basically. So yeah, you are cutting this at some radius capital R, and then you want to send that R to infinity, and you are integrating over this half circle at infinity, basically. So now this integral seems, well, there's a suppression by k square here. So it is sort of intuitive that that integral should go to zero. It's a precise mathematical lemma which tells you, called Jordan lemma, that indeed this is the case. Okay, so the integral I over I3 goes to zero And this, you know, is supported by so-called Jordan lemma. Sorry, so this is just a mathematical thing, right? Okay. So I3 is 0. So then we have 0 equal to whatever. So I is equal to I1 plus I2. Okay, so all we have to do is to calculate what is the contribution of this small circle around this pole and contribution of that circle around that pole. Right? So now again, mathematics, if you actually, you know, go epsilon close to the pole, then mathematician will tell you, well, how to calculate the circle is through the residua in that pole, right? And so what we get here is I pi residuum of our function f of k, where, you know, k is minus omega plus residuum f of k, k is plus omega, where I define f of k to be whatever we need to integrate. So it's the k times e kr over k squared minus omega squared. So now this pi here, I pi, well, it's always I, right? But the pi comes, so typically you have 2 pi, because you go all around in the whole circle. The angle sort of goes from 0 to 2 pi. Here, the angle only counts from here to there. So that's why there's only pi, it's an angle pi. So if you want to go around, you know, the pole, whatever the angle, that angle enters here. Yes?
I'm sorry, but shouldn't there be a 2 pi? Isn't the formula 2 pi I times the residues?
Here.
Shouldn't there be a factor of 2?
I just said that, okay? So, you know, if you had a pole and you go, I have a pole, and then I go around some angle, let's call that angle theta, and that's precisely that angle that enters that formula here, right? If typically you want to go all the way around the pole, then this is 2 pi. If you go just half, it's just a pi. So this angle is precisely what enters here. This is the theta angle or whatever. Well, let's not call it theta. Anyway, so that's only that's why it's only pi. Okay. Yes.
Isn't that assuming that your integral is like you're integrating over a constant function?
What is assuming?
You can cut the integral into half and say it's the half of them is I pi. It's kind of like you're saying you're integrating over a constant function, so you can cut how many slices you want.
Well, I don't know whether it's a constant thing, but certainly, you know, this is how you calculate the integrals around the poles. So this is what comes out from the complex analysis. I don't know whether you can say it's like an integration, a constant. If it's a constant, probably works, right? I don't know. Yeah. Okay, very good. So we have these things. So now the question is how to calculate these residua, how to calculate whatever. So residuum, some beast. But the residuum is easy to calculate when you have a simple pole, which means when your function, which blows up at that pole, has only, you know, single root at that pole. Of course, we have our function is k squared minus omega squared, which is, of course, written as k minus omega times k plus omega. So we have a simple pole at omega and at minus omega. There's only divergence once, right? If we had k minus omega squared, that would not be a simple pole, and it would be much, much bigger divergence than this one here. So there's a nice divergence at omega and minus omega, because there's just one of these things here. Right? In that case, you have a beautiful formula that the residuum of function, x equals to c f of x, is simply limit z, the complex thing, z goes to c, and then z minus c f of z, if, you know, this is a simple pole. So this is how you calculate the residuum in case of simple poles. If you have more complicated poles, there's still a way how to calculate the residuum, but it's more complicated than this. Okay, so that's again what mathematician friend gives us. Okay, so let's do it, right? So let's do first k equal to omega here. That will be simpler. So what does it mean? So I have to multiply by k minus omega. So I will have k times e to I kr k minus omega k plus omega. So now I multiply by k minus omega, right? And take the limit k goes to omega. So that will be the other residuum. Well, okay. So I just got rid of the divergence, which prevented me from taking the simple limit. So this is gone. And then just wherever I see, I plug k equal to omega. So this gives us omega e omega r divided by 2 omega. Or right? So this thing here is just e to I omega r divided by 2. Similarly, you will find that, well, now I'm just plugging minus omega there. So the only dependence on omega is here. So this will give us minus I omega r divided by. And so our I is just I pi over 2 e to minus I omega r plus e to plus omega r. It's a horrible calculation. I wanted to avoid it, but you insisted that I have to do it. Okay. Very good. So we have I. So the last thing which we have to do, so we know what I is here, but we still have to do the integral over omega, right? So this is our result. We still need to do that. So g of r and t is 1 over 2 pi cube 1 over ir integral d omega e to minus I omega t, and then whatever we have here, I pi over 2 e to minus I omega r plus e to plus I omega r. All right, so that's what our final thing is. Okay, so the I is here, can be cancelled, is a pi here, so this is equal to 1 over 8, well, 16 pi square. Okay, 1 over r, and then you see I have an integral, and of course the integral over the frequencies is from minus infinity to infinity. So minus infinity to infinity d omega, and then you have one term which is e to minus I omega t plus r, and then the other term is e to minus I omega t minus r. All right. So we are done, right? So now the integral over omega is super simple. It's just an integral of the exponential, which is what I told you maybe 20 minutes ago, is the integral representation of the delta function, right? So if I have 1 over 2 pi, and then the omega e to I omega something, It's just the delta of that something, right? So for that, I need to borrow 2 pi here. So this is equal to, if I just, you know, factor out the 2 pi, then I'll have 1 over 8 pi left. 1 over r is left. But then I have a delta function of t plus r and delta function of t minus r. Everybody happy? Okay, so now we arrived at the most important result. And so we know that what the, let me do a definition. So that's what we have seen last time. So we can define the retarded Green function as 1 over 4 pi r delta r minus t. And then we can define the advanced Green function as the same thing. But now r plus t is just a definition. And if you stare at this, you see that our Green function, which we just calculated, well, instead of 1 over 4 pi, it has 1 over 8 pi. So it is equal to 1 half of gr plus t advanced. Well, this is what we derived in our calculation, is that the Green function, which we have calculated over here in this horrible calculation, is just 1 half of the retarded plus 1 half of the advanced. Okay. Very good. So it seems like our physics should have both potentials. It should have the retarded potential, which is propagating. Now I have a disturbance. So there's only a propagation on the light cone. So this is the light cone propagation, right? Propagation. So if you have, you know, point P here, then if you have retarded Green function, there will be a propagation like this on the light cone. This is, let's say this is 45 degrees. Okay, so this is what GR gives you. On the other hand, the advanced propagation, I think it's what will happen like this. So in other words, you know, something happens. So this is time and this is space, right? So if I have like a, you know, space-time picture, this is a propagation in time, then I know that, you know, whatever is affected here, and it took some time to propagate from this disturbance of P, I shake my electron here, I propagate over here, and so it, you know, what happens here is much later than when the source actually acted. That's not true for the advanced one, right? So basically, you know, you have some disturbance here, which is caused by the source here, but the disturbance is much earlier than the source actually did something, right? So this is, okay. So people don't like advanced, and so in classical electrodynamics, only retarded functions considered. So you don't want to have effect before the cause. Yes.
Say that those are the effect of that charge moving if they are before it in time. Like, why isn't it a valid interpretation to say maybe there were fields before that were just like a solution of this equation, and then eventually they're there's a wiggle of a charge that cancels them out just right or something like that.
Sure, you could say that, but then you are still evolving according to the retarded potential, right? So then, yeah, you could say that. But if I want to use the advanced one, I will have the behavior that really sometimes, you know, the effect is preceded by the cause, right? That's what this tells you, right? So I have to sort of like propagate backwards in time or whatever. Right, so of course, you know, you can say whatever happened here comes from the source, which is over here, but then you are evolving according to the retarded functions only, right? And so, okay.
So, like the whole, can you say that the whole description is complete with just the retarded ones then?
Well, that's what people try to say here, right? Precisely what people try to say is that, well, we don't need the advanced ones. We can just get around with the retarded ones, but then you are making, you know, then you are breaking, you know, you're introducing the arrow of time basically, and you are breaking time symmetry. But because this is a fundamental theory, microscopic theory sort of, right? You don't want really to do that, right? So you maybe want that, you know, the time symmetry is broken as an emergent phenomenon. But typically what you want is that the microscopically the theories are time symmetric, right? And so that's, you know, what's not true here. Yes, was there a question? Yeah.
Are the two Green functions due like there because you chose this particular contour? Like what?
Okay, very good. So that's a very good question, which I want to discuss in a minute. So yeah. Remember that question, okay? So anyway, So people only choose the retarded functions, and so the time symmetry here, time symmetry, is broken at a microscopic level for a fundamental theory, right? So I'm very vague here, right? But anyway, so like for a fundamental theory, you know that in Hamiltonian dynamics you can go both ways, right? I can start here and I can, you know, evolve backward in time, or I can evolve forward in time, doesn't matter, right? So the Hamilton's equations don't care about the arrow of time, right? But here suddenly I'm saying, well, actually the Maxwell equations or whatever I'm doing in Maxwell's theory will care about the arrow of time. And so that's something which people don't like or whatever. But anyway, so this is nevertheless what's, you know, assumed at the classical, you know, level. There is, however, another theory which I will mention next week a little bit more, and you will derive the corresponding action. And that's called Feynman-Wheeler theory. And basically, Feynman and Wheeler were, well, they came to this from a different perspective. But in the end, what is amazing is that they formulated a theory which is macroscopically time reversible. So alternative here, which is very much appealing, is the Feynman-Wheeler theory. How do you spell that? Feynman-Wheeler theory. And this Feynman-Wheeler theory really uses the G which we derived over here. This is G, which is precisely 1/2 retarded plus 1/2 advance, which is microscopically reversible. I'm reversible. So then, you know, it really uses these potentials as well. And then you may be asking, well, how can that this theory actually was not experimentally ruled out? And the answer is, well, it uses this, you know, very nice potential, but it uses different boundary conditions. So basically, the time asymmetry which we observe, the fact that really there is never something that, you know, the effect is preceding the cause, just enters into this theory through the boundary condition. Plus proper boundary conditions. Which actually, you know, so that this is completely equivalent to Maxwell. So it is very, very interesting that, you know, you can either do with just the retarded potentials. You break your theory microscopically, and then you know you just use basically only half of the physics, and this is somehow equivalent to using you know the full physics, both retarded and advanced. But now just the time asymmetry enters through the boundary condition. Okay, and so I think it's very very nice theory. So I encourage you to study this theory, and you will see it next week as well. Yes.
I feel like I feel like. The impression to me is that the Green's functions are a mathematical device that
is
subsidiary to the real theory.
Okay.
And like from the wave equations or whatever, like sort of considering everything locally and not thinking about Green's functions too much, like you could evolve just whatever state you have forward in time. So it feels like these are just an apparatus that breaks time symmetry. Because we wanted to solve something explicitly in terms of the charges, and the real theory isn't time irreversible.
Well, let's not. Well, you know, choosing this G, of course, gives me that phi, right? And so if I just choose the retarded G, it's just me retarded phi. So really, if I move the electron here, only later on I will have you know some disturbance here, not earlier. Right? So it's a physical effect. It's not just a mathematical concept of the Green function. You know, given Green function, it gives you the physical field. And the physical field either is retarded or advanced. Okay, so now returning back to your question. So of course, you know, I have chosen the integral I to be the principal value here. So, okay, a few remarks. Remarks on calculation. And you know that maybe makes you more happy. I don't know. Probably not. So the first remark would be that you know we have identified I with principal value. That means that you know, as we have the complex plane, we have the pole here, and the pole here. Our I was this, and between the pole plus that, right? We didn't include the poles, right? So that's our I. And so then there was question. Well, does it matter how I close the contour? What if I, for example, didn't choose this contour here, but I chose it? I close it here. Well. Okay, if you chose it here, let's say like that, and then you use the Cauchy whatever integral formula, then of course now integrating over this thing here would contain the pole. Okay, so very good. So it seems like I would be getting a different result, but then you would be saying the principal value is not well defined. It depends how I go around the pole. Of course, that's not true, because if I chose it here, of course the you know this wouldn't be zero, but the contribution of this integral I1 prime now would be different than the contribution of I1. And they would in the end cancel, and you would get the same result for I. So you know, this principal value is well defined, which means unique, and which means independent of the choice. Of class of integration. You can try to play with that if you don't believe me. But you know, if I decided to, you know, crazy things, I decided to close the contour, you know, here, as long as you know you can make the I3 vanish. But even if I3 does not vanish, it gives you some contribution. If I close it like that, go around the pole randomly. Once I made my choice, which is the physical choice, I identify I with the principal value. Then it doesn't matter how you close your contour or how you do the integration. You still get the same result. Okay? So that's remark number one. Remark number two. But on the other hand, why did we choose the principal value? Right? Nobody told us to choose the principal value. We can choose something else. We can identify I you know, with these contours as well, right? That would be a different physical choice. Okay, so second, nobody told us that principal value is the right thing to do. After all, you know, we just want to do the right thing to do. After all, what we just want to do is that we want to calculate the real integral over k from minus infinity to infinity, right? And how we define this, well, this integral is still defined because you cross two poles, right? But how you make it well defined is up to you. Either the principal value, or we can include some poles. So for example, we could choose the integral as follows. So another choice, for example, would be, for example, to identify I prime, which would be this thing here plus that thing there. So I have one pole here, another pole here, and we would identify our integral like that. Okay, so now we are defining, you know, these things to be part of your integral, to be part of your minus infinity to plus infinity integral. Before, we just left them out, but now we include this. So then, of course, well, you would get I here, but now you include this piece here. That piece here just picks up the residuum here at that point. But now we are going opposite, so there'll be a minus I pi over 2, e to minus I omega r. And then this thing here, we are going the right direction as we were going before, so it's plus I pi over 2, e to plus I omega r. Okay, and so you get a different integral. And if you look at what that integral gives you, it gives you this gives you g equals to gr. So this is the right thing to do if you just want to recover the retarded Green function. Okay. Or there's another choice you can make. Or you can do I double prime, which is same thing, we have two poles here, but now we choose this thing here. Okay, and that will be I plus I pi over 2 e to minus I omega r minus I pi over 2 e to I omega r. And that gives you the advanced function. So really, you know, it seems like at the classical level, it's up to you to decide what I want my potential to be, right? It's like how you define your complex integration. But certainly, you know, all kinds are possible. So you can choose GA, you can choose GR, you can choose anything, but you know, your choice has physical consequences. In standard Maxwell's theory, you just choose retarded. So it seems like the right thing to do is to choose this integration constant if you want to recover Maxwell's theory. If you want to recover time symmetric theory, you choose this integral, principal value. If you just want opposite of Maxwell, you choose this integral. Okay, and again, you know, once you make this choice, your integration is unique. Doesn't matter how you close the contour or whatever you do. Questions? Isn't this beautiful? Okay, so we have that. So with this in mind, we can construct the retarded and advanced potentials which you used. Well, use only retarded ones, but you can recover both of them. And you can use them to study radiation and so on. So Yes?
I'm not understanding why this, like, steps 2 and 3, why they lead to g equals gr and g equals ga.
Oh, well, just do the calculation. The statement is this is, you know, the contribution of this piece here.
Right, that makes sense, but why that do is the g equals gr?
Oh, you just repeat the calculation. So this is just, you know, the definition of I. But remember, I still have to integrate I over omega or something like that, right? The second step. Did I just delete it? Oh, is that over there, right? This is the first one. So once you have the I, which is this piece, you still have to do the integral over omega. Right, but the I will now change because I am now adding these poles and whatever. So the I will be different than that, and it will precisely, you know, change things that only one piece will be present, and it will kill the other piece, or if you choose, you know, one or the other. So just you know, try to do it. It's a nice exercise. All right, so and then it will just recover the retarded or advanced potential.
Can I have a question?
Yes.
Is this choice of GR the same as restricting ourselves to the proper Lorentz group?
Sorry, is the choice of
GR the same as restricting ourselves to the proper Lorentz group? A killing time reflection symmetry?
Is it? I don't know, is it? So certainly you can do the time reversal, and that would, yeah, that will break this, right? It will just map retarded to advanced. But you don't do that. I think so. It must be related somehow. Yeah.
Well, I have a question.
Yes.
What if we choose the path both like goes the under the pole like this?
Yeah.
Then we should add two turns for the I. Then
and you get a new green function. And it may be called after you if you can convince people that it's useful. Okay. So then there is also a Feynman propagator, right? Which is something else. Or maybe it's that one. I don't know. So you know, in quantum theory, all possible green functions actually are physical, right? And so it depends on what you want to do. And you know, it's a difference between Weidmann's function and you know, whatever time-ordered function. And so you have all these things different. But in principle, all these green functions are useful, and especially in quantum theory, right? So yes.
Do they give rise to the same physics, or?
Well, apparently not, right? Apparently not. yeah. But
so why aren't we using this result to say that maybe green function is not the best way to express the solutions of Maxwell equations in terms of like?
No, but. Okay, so at the quantum theory.
It has these degenerate solutions. Maybe it's not complete. Maybe it's not the best way to.
I mean, Maxwell's theory experimentally confirmed, right? As long as I choose retarded Green's functions, then there's no experimental disprovement of Maxwell theory classically, right? It's only when the energies are super, you know, super high, then you have to go to the quantum theory, right? And then.
But it still has this freedom, which means that, to me, it means that functions has more freedom than what we actually need for the solutions of this set of equations that we have. Like maybe it's a complete solution.
You will see that in quantum theory, you'll still be using Green's functions. It's just it's not necessarily the retarded Green function. You will use all of them. Okay. So, but still, quantum field theory based on Green's function. So it's not that you are throwing away all this physics here. You'll be using again, and then you'll just see it. So the classical one works perfectly well with the retarded, or perfectly well with the full G, which is 1/2 retarded plus 1/2 advanced, provided that you impose different boundary conditions. But that's where you expect the validity of classical theory to be true, then you can recover everything, right? From there, from that choice.
What are the boundary conditions that you have to impose to make the symmetric theory work?
It's a very, very simple boundary condition. It's called perfect absorber. And it says that, basically, you have at your boundary a thing which absorbs all the waves, and there is basically nothing. Which would be normal. You have a perfect absorber at the boundary, and that's enough to break this time symmetry, and you know make it equivalent to Maxwell.
Another question. Is it even possible to experimentally verify the existence of the advanced G? Because wouldn't you have to go back in time in order to do that?
Well, it simply means that, you know, something happens before, you know, the source could act, right? And so we have never seen that. We always know that, you know, we throw the stone in the water and then the waves start propagating, right? It's not that the waves propagate and then actually after the stone is thrown. In the water. So yeah, we just don't see it, right, in everyday life.
Why do we see a wave, why do we insist on ascribing it to the cause that was in the past? Like, isn't the wave the state of the system at that time, and it doesn't have to have come from anything or to have gone to anything?
But why
can't we just say, well, in 30 years there's going to be a particle that makes that wave?
Sure, you can say that, but nobody has ever observed that, right? Well, if you wait 30 years, probably not, but if you wait 1 minute. Or anyway, well, let me continue. So in Maxwell, only retarded. Let me just concentrate on this case. Considered. And so our solution for phi of R and T, well, it's 4 pi integral d3r prime dt prime, and then the g, which is the retarded one, where is it? It's just disappeared. This thing here. So it's 1 over 4 pi r, 1 over 4 pi, r is r minus r prime, and then delta of r minus r prime minus t prime, returning back our definition of capital R and capital T, and then rho of r prime t prime. And we already have the d3r dt prime, right? And so what people typically do is that one integral which is easy to perform is the integral over t prime, right? So I can just use this delta function. So instead of writing t prime, I write t minus that, right? And so the 4 pi cancel here. And so this is an integral d3r prime, 1 over r minus r prime, and then rho, and then r prime. And then instead of t prime, I'm writing t minus r prime. All right, so this is how I integrate over time prime. This is called retarded time. And so the corresponding solution is called retarded potential. Because this is the retarded time. And precisely, it captures the fact that if I want to find a field at R, actually, there had to be a disturbance at t minus r prime. There's a it propagates at the speed of light, so there's actually ct minus r prime or whatever. And so the source had to be there before at this retarded time. And then it took some time to propagate for the disturbance, and it reached our point later. Okay, and so similarly, of course, as we solve wave equation for phi, or the equation for A is exactly the same, except we just, you know, change rho to J. And that's what you were using in your homework. Your happy homework. Who has finished the homework? Some people have. Okay. Okay, very good. So that's about, you know, solving the wave equation. And so now you solve the whole Maxwell theory, right? Basically, because, you know, we started with Maxwell equations, you make them wave equations, and now we solve the wave equation. So everything is done, right? Not quite. You still have to solve the homogeneous part of the wave equation, you know, and that's, and then you may impose some boundary conditions, and so it gets more complicated, right? But basically, we are basically done. Right. So now let's look now at a point-like source. So we have a single electron. And so you have time t here. And then you have, you know, x or whatever. And so then the electron sort of propagates to your space time. Okay, so that's the trajectory. You have x of t prime. And then you are asking, okay, so I want to know at this given instead of time, and at that given x, I want to know what the corresponding field is produced by this electron. Okay, so I have a, you know, field phi here at r and t, and then we want to know what that field is. And that field is given by a famous solution, which is called linear Wiecott potentials. So this will be a linear Wiecott potential phi. And how do you get it, right? So it's very simple how you get it. We know that the disturbances propagate at the speed of light, right? And so that could only be a disturbance when, you know, there's a propagation on that light cone, right? So the field at this point could only actually originate from from the past light cone here. So this is where, you know, it could come from. So it had to come from, you know, this point when the electron was here, you know, it was accelerating or moving or whatever. But anyway, so that's when he emitted some perturbance, and that perturbance reached that point later here, right? So this is x at t retarded, right? And so, well, this distance in time is simply t minus t retarded. And this distance in space, because the light cone is 45 degrees, is just r minus x of t retarded. The absolute value is this distance here. Okay, so then the question is, what is the, in order to find the potential phi, we need to specify what the charge density at that point was, right? So more generally, if you have charge density at r prime and t prime, just given by the charge of the electron, E, and where the electron is. So it's r prime minus x of t prime. Right, so the electron is located wherever it is located, where the trajectory is at that point. And similarly, if you wanted to do all the vector potential, but we will not do it here, but anyway, so gj r prime and t prime is the same thing. But now we have the velocity as well. So the current is the charge times velocity, right? So it would be E times V of T prime, and the same thing, R prime minus X of T prime, where V of T prime is simply dx T prime divided by dt prime. All right, so this is if you wanted to calculate the vector potential as well. Okay. So very good. So let's just do it, right? So this is our phi. So when we derive this retarded potential over here, what we did is that, you know, we have this, you know, four-dimensional integral, d3r prime and dt prime. Right? It's a four-dimensional integral which we have to do. So now for a general source, it's useful to integrate over dt prime. Just use the delta function. And this is what you get, right? Instead, now we have a nice delta function in the r direction, right? So let me return back to this four-dimensional integral and integrate the three-dimensional integral instead of the time integral. Okay, and so all right. So let's return back to this. You have pi r and t. So the 4 pi is gone is d3r prime, dt prime, r minus r prime. I'm just writing the formula there. Delta, what is it? D prime minus d retarded, rho r prime, d prime. Okay, and then if I plug for this, it'll be E delta r prime minus x of t retarded. And I want to do now the integral over r prime instead of integral over t prime. Oh, is that what I want? Just a second. Okay. So I want to do the integral over r prime. So if you look at that, that integral over r prime is super simple. Just whenever I see r prime, I just put x of tr. Right? So this is an integral dt prime r minus x of tr. Delta t prime minus t retarded and e. But the t retarded now, well, what it was? It was t minus minus r prime, but r prime is now just x of t retarded, right? Something isn't right here. Prime. Oh, okay, very good. T prime. Something isn't right here. Sorry. So it's correct, it's t retarded. But the problem is that I have to use the general expression for that. So it will be delta r prime minus x of t prime. I'm sorry for that. So there'll be t prime here. And then correspondingly, there will be t prime here. OK. So, and it's t prime here as well. X of t r. Okay, so what you really want to do is an integral over dt prime, and then there's a delta of some function of t prime divided by r minus x of t prime, where this function of t prime is just t prime minus t plus r minus x of t prime. Okay. So in other words, I cannot do the delta functions easily because you know there's a t prime hiding here in this thing here. So it's not of the form delta of t prime minus something, which is fixed, but it's rather of the form t prime minus something which depends on t prime. Right? It's some kind of implicit function. Right? And then there's a beautiful mathematical formula which tells you, well, if I have delta of f of t prime, then it better contribute, where the pole, where the roots of t prime are. And there may be more roots, so you sum over all roots, i, and then you do t prime minus t I, and then you do derivative evaluated at the ti. Probably seen this formula. Okay. So now we're going to use this formula. Decompose the delta function of some function as the sum over the roots of that function, and then you have derivative of the function evaluated at the corresponding root. So now we can use my mistake to know the answer. So what t prime has to be? So how many roots are there so that there is a non-trivial contribution? Yes?
Sorry, I'm just a bit confused what t prime and r prime are. Are they dummy variables of integration, or do they correspond to that intersection point of the light cone with the motion of the electron?
What do you think?
Dummy variables.
So here, yeah, so this was my mistake, right? So here, it was a double variable, right? I'm integrating over t prime, right? But for that, I need to write down what the trajectory of the particle is. So still, I have t prime there, right? But then the question is, how many contributions this will have, really, right? And then you are exactly right. How many contributions there will be in reality? There will be only one contribution, which comes from the last past light cone, right? So here I'm pretending, in the calculation I'm pretending I can have, whatever the t prime contribution, I can have still contribution from here, the contribution from there. So I'm integrating over all t primes, right? But reality, I know that there will be only one contribution, which is the one which lies on the intersection of the trajectory with the past light cone. Okay, so only this contributes. Which means that only when t prime equals to t retarded will contribute. Okay. Very good. So when I actually trying, and then there's an E here still, and the electrons charge. So when I'm trying to solve this thing here, I have to sum over all solutions when this is zero. But the only solution is at the retarded time. Okay, so in other words, this will just have, in our case, there'll be only one of these poles, e prime minus the true retarded time. Okay, and then f prime at t retarded. Okay. That's the only one which contributes. And well, what is this f prime, right? So I have to differentiate function f with respect to t prime. Okay, t prime is here, so I get 1. T is independent of t prime, so that's fine. But then I have this thing here, which is an absolute value of r minus x of t prime. Right? So what is that? It's r, it's a vector, right? So this thing here. Well, what is it? It's a square root of r vector minus x vector of t prime times the same thing, r vector minus x vector of t prime. Right? So that's what this absolute value means. It's a square root of product of two vectors, right? So now if I differentiate that with respect to time, okay, so this is delta t prime minus tr. Okay, so if I differentiate t prime, I get 1. Then if I differentiate t, I get 0, minus 0. And then if I differentiate this absolute value, well, okay, square root, so I get 1 half, 1 over square root, plus 1 half, 1 over square root, which is r minus x of tr. But also, I have to differentiate what is inside that square root, right? So inside, I will have two terms, one where I differentiate this and leave that one, and one where I differentiate that and leave this one. So it will be two times. The terms are the same. And then let's put r minus x of tr. And then I differentiate the second one. So now if you look at the second one, which depends on t prime, well, this does not. Well, this does. I will have a minus dx t prime over dt prime, which gives me the velocity at t prime. OK, so there's a minus. And then v at t retarded. And so we're done. So the 2 cancel is the 1 half. And so that's our delta function. So that's this piece here. Okay. But we still have this 1 over x minus t prime here. OK, there will be another. You know, r minus x phi. So the phi of r and t is, well, given by e, and then r minus x of tr, and then minus r minus x of tr times v at tr. And that's called linear decoupled potential. Okay, so this potential, whatever, however we arrived at it, you know, it just tells us, you know, if I have a propagation of single particle, that single particle will produce field at point r and t, which is given simply by, you know, the distance between the two points, and, you know, product between the r and v of that particle, but everything evaluated at the retarded time. Okay. And so this is really, well, it's amazing that you can write this for Maxwell's theory. You cannot write it for any other theory in of electromagnetism, which we will discuss next week. But for this specific theory, you can really write what the fields are produced by a single source. Okay, and then, of course, if you have a couple of sources, you can, because the theory is linear, you can superimpose these solutions, and then you get the general solution. So similarly, if you did this for the vector potential A, the only difference is that instead of E, you will have E times V. So there will be another V here. And then this gives you the A. Yes?
So because Maxwell's equations are linear, we can add any other like plane wave or anything else that is a wave onto this, and it's OK. Are there any like concise, nice conditions that this satisfy? Like this plus a plane wave wouldn't satisfy that takes out this uniquely.
Sorry, so once you start introducing nonlinearities, this will not be true, right? So in Einstein theory, it won't be true, right?
I mean, this theory,
So in this theory, everything is linear. You can always superimpose, right? You can always superimpose everything.
So I guess my question then is, why is the linear Dirichlet potential this thing and not this thing plus a plane wave in the x direction? Like, why is this the one?
Well, You mean plane wave would be like a solution of a homogeneous equation or whatever? Yeah, you can always add those. Yeah, sure, sure. But they because it's a solution of the homogeneous equation, you wouldn't say that you know solution is necessarily produced by this point charge or whatever, right? It's something that can you know come from you know external things and whatever, right? So it's something which does not have any sources, which means the sources typically come from infinity or you know something that freely propagates in your space time. So yes, you can start adding those. But here you are basically interested in the special solution which is produced by your source, which is present there, right? So you can... yeah. More questions?
If we restore the constant for the speed of light,
yes,
it appears to be V over C.
So it better, you know, everything works better. Yeah, the units has to be correct, right? So this is the humans units of length. So this better be dimensionless, so I would expect it to be over C. Yeah. More questions?
Is this formula only true when we require that the trajectory of the electron is independent of the field it creates?
Yes, of course. Yeah. So you know, once you start... Yeah. Very good. So typically, you know, what happens is that, and we are going to slightly discuss that actually, is that you know, the source can start interacting with its own field, right? And that's typically bad because it leads to some strange effects, right? So basically, you know, you start accelerating an electron, and if you start accelerating anything, it starts producing its own fields, starts producing waves, okay? But then, you know, the electron itself can interact with its own wave. And so typically, you know, and that's called radiation reaction force, right? So basically the electron acts on itself, and then you know it changes, of course, trajectory of the electron. So you know, yeah.
The theory says that this solution is physical, right? The Beck reaction.
So certainly, you know, the Beck reaction is physical, and people did not know how to explain it, and especially it was a huge challenge for this theory with you know half retarded and half advanced potentials. How do you explain the Beck reaction? But it can still, everything can be done, okay? So it can be done in Maxwell's theory, it can be done here. I will try to talk about it next week if we have time, but let's leave it out for today. More questions?
If we use the alternative theory from Feynman and Wheeler, we have still got to learn which Wickard's potential because we need to have derived that as well.
Yeah. So in that case, you would have two contributions, right? You would have not only contribution from you know from the past light cone, but you would also have a contribution from this point here, right? So there will be two fields, well, two contributions to that integral which you are doing. So now you know when you integrate over this delta, whatever. When we do this here, it will be only t prime minus t retarded, but we also be t prime plus t advanced, and you would have two solutions, and yeah, you basically superimpose them.
Yeah, but how would that make sense? Because we have two potentials. One of them comes from a point charge from the light cone of the past, and
yeah.
One of them comes from future. But potential, but you could take the gradient of the potential, and assuming there is no, that's not a good assumption. And well, calculating the vector potential as well, you could probably calculate the magnetic field and also the electric field. Wouldn't that change the magnetic and electric field if you assume that the Feynman-Wheeler?
You are asking very very good question, and the answer is if you this theory has to have proper boundary conditions. The proper boundary conditions basically have to do with something like how many electrons in your universe are, right? So okay, that's also a boundary condition. So now the statement is, if you have just one electron in your universe and nothing else, this and that will be very different, okay? So the statement is that if you had only one electron, you know, the field would be very different because it has two contributions from advanced and from retarded and whatever. Now, if you have many, many, many electrons in your universe, that you know can absorb some of the waves, And if it can absorb some of the waves, it can change, you know, whatever the thing is. So the statement is, if you have only one electron as we have here, solutions are different. If you have many more electrons in the universe, the solutions converge to be the same. But then I have to superimpose over all the fields.
In the limit of the number of electrons going to infinity, these two theories would become equivalent.
Yeah.
But if you assumed...
Provided the boundary conditions are. Yeah.
But if you assume the finite number of electrons, what would happen then?
Then they will be different. But of course, our universe is huge, and it has lots of electrons. So it's reasonable to expect that, yeah, well, then they are equivalent. So this is similar to, you know, Mach's principle of inertia, which you might have heard, and you will probably discuss in general relativity. So again, you know, the question was like, where does the inertial mass come from, right? And so Einstein doesn't answer you. He just, you know, assumes that inertial mass is equal to the gravitational mass. It's the equivalence principle. But then, you know, philosophers were asking, well, where does it come from? And one of the theories, which is, you know, Mach's theory, says, well, it actually comes from interacting with the other massive bodies. So now, if you basically have empty universe and have only one mass here, then its inertial mass will be zero. Okay? But if you have lots of, you know, massive bodies, you have lots of stars in the universe and so on, then the theory gives you precisely, you know, it gives rise, the interaction between, you know, this thing and the massive body, it gives you that the inertial mass is, you know, this and that, and then it equals to the gravitational mass. So that's like a derivation of the equivalence principle, but it only works if you have lots of matter in the universe with which your particle is interacting. So this is the same spirit. Like, so
is there any other implication of this theory that could be tested?
Well,
compare it to when we only had the retorted term.
This one here. Yeah.
Because this one, you say that because our universe is really big and we have a lot of electrons, they're basically. But is that the only point on which they differed if number of electrons were finite? Is there anything?
Yeah. So certainly you can pursue this theory. You can say, well, I have only finite number. That then you start modifying your boundary conditions a little bit, and then of course they start differing, and that could be in principle testing, right?
In principle, what would be in principle testing?
Well, you would see some, you know, violations of retarded.
Are you talking about electrons were finite?
Yeah.
So I'm saying, is there anything different in the limit of when we take the limit of number of electrons to infinity?
No, then
completely equivalent?
Yeah, completely equivalent at the classical level.
What about the relativistic limit?
No, this is all relativistic, right? This is all relativistic. At the quantum level, they will start differing, right? At the quantum level, they will start differing because people know how to do quantum field theory of normal Maxwell theory. But they don't know how to do quantum field theory of Feynman-Wheeler theory. Okay, so that's why they are different, because people don't know how to do it.
What is the physical meaning of this theory?
I mean, it's just so appealing because you have this microscopic time reversibility, right? And I think that's very appealing for physicists, because everything seems like time reversible at the fundamental level, and it seems that, you know, the arrow of time and whatever is just emerging. When you start losing some, you know, you have to involve things like entropy and, you know, increase and stuff like that. So it's like a phenomenological implication, which comes from dirty physics, right? But at the fundamental level, you would expect that everything is time symmetric. And so this theory satisfies that Maxwell theory does not. Okay, anyway, let me stop here. Okay.
Can I follow up? What is the problem with quantizing the Feynman-Wheeler
theory? Read about that in Feynman's book. Surely you must be joking, Mr. Feynman. So it's like, obviously, he presented this in front of big brains like Einstein and whatever in Princeton. And then they ask him why Wheeler did not present this seminar. And so, like, Wheeler is working on this, on the quantum theory for this, and he will present it next week. And then, of course, he never presented it. And nobody knows how to quantize it. And the reason is that basically this theory is sort of like non-local, right? Well, in the sense that if you quantize normal field theory, you just need to know what the field is at that point, and you need to know what the corresponding momentum is at that point, and you just impose canonical commutation relations and stuff like that, right? But here, what you need to know is basically you need to know the positions of all the electrons. And you need to trace, well, you need to look at the past light cone at the point where you are looking at the field. And that's contributed by all the electrons on that, you know, which of the trajectories intersecting that past light cone, right? And there are many contributions. So basically, to understand the field here, you need to know the motion of all the electrons throughout the whole space-time, right? And so that's like, it looks like non-local, and it's very difficult. And then we'll explain you what kind of Green functions you can have in quantum field theory.